Okay, I'd like to convene the Ways and Means Committee, and we have the minutes from April 8th in the folders. Representative Olson?
Mr. Chair, I move the minutes.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion on the minutes of April 8th? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. We're going to take one bill out of order because it should be, I think, a fairly brief discussion. Representative Halverson's House File 5. This is a bill that is being duly tracked. We had it as part of the jobs bill yesterday, and it's also going to be reported out as a separate bill. So we did have that opportunity for discussion yesterday. So we will request that Representative Halverson give us a brief update on the bill, and there will be an amendment dealing with a tax issue in the bill that means that it can be re-referred directly to the House floor, where the one yesterday as part of jobs went over to the tax committee. So there will be that difference once we are done. Representative Liebling, would you care to move the division report?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move adoption of the Health and Human Services Finance Division report on House File 5.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 5 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Okay, that motion is before us. Representative Liebling, would you care to move the amendment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the A14 amendment.
Okay, now the A14 amendment, I think I gave a... That this is the author's amendment. That's right. I was jumping ahead to the next one. If you just care to mention if there's anything of substance in the amendment or if it's just a housekeeping amendment, whatever the situation is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. The A14 amendment is work that has been continuous through this process with this bill. This is our ninth committee step, and we have had numerous amendments along the way as we have worked with stakeholders. This is comes out of conversation we had during the state government finance discussion, and we needed more clarification on the ability for an employer to offer a private plan and what the parameters of those private plans would be. And so this just clarifies that a comparable private plan would be acceptable for an application to provide a private plan as opposed to the state plan if it met the total dollar value. So that is... the purpose of this is just to provide more clarity regarding private plans.
Representative Grapple. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to either the author or to staff. Lines 1.9 through 1.12 of the amendment, can you talk about what each of those do?
And if you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, Ben Weeks from House Research. Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, 1.9, 1.10, and 1.11 lower the premium rates in the bill. 1.9 is for employers who have no private plan at all. 1.10 is the premium rate for employers who had a private plan for the family leave portion and not the medical benefit portion. And 1.11 would be for employers who adopted a private plan for the medical leave portion but not the family leave portion. And those new tax rates are in line with the most up-to-date fiscal note, which reflected a cap on the grants to small businesses for worker replacement and therefore lowered the cost. 1.12 deletes all the general fund appropriations in the bill, and my understanding is because those are being carried in the jobs omnibus bill and several other finance bills.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Grapple.
Mr. Chairman, I want to make sure the motion from Representative Liebling was to send this bill to taxes, but in your previous comments, you mentioned that we're basically taking amendments to make this a bill that can bypass the tax committee. Did I hear that right?
The motion that when we adopt the upcoming amendment that removes the tax provision means it will go directly to the House floor.
Okay, so Representative Liebling will be making
there will be no reason to go to taxes once its amendment. It's the A-15 amendment that removes the provision dealing with taxes.
So, Mr. Chairman, and to the author of the bill, the benefits under this program, should this be enacted, are those benefits taxable?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, when we adopt the A-15 amendment, they will be considered taxable.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Garofalo.
And Representative Halverson, where is that being carried then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, can you clarify that question, please?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Halverson, so this is going to be a general fund revenue raiser. Where is that being carried?
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, this is, I guess I still don't understand the question. What do you mean, where is it being carried?
Maybe that's the question. Would Mr. Marks be prepared to answer that one? Mr. Marks?
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, the benefits being taxable has not been assumed to be a revenue raiser at this point, or has not been assumed to be raising revenue. We had a revenue estimate that the benefits being a tax deduction would lose income tax revenue because there are a number of employees who already get those benefits and they are taxable. By making them tax exempt would have a cost relative to that. I don't know if I suppose in the long term there would be some additional tax revenue that's not being counted anywhere at this point.
Okay, so.
Representative Graff.
So, Mr. Chairman, my understanding was that the reason why this amendment is being offered is because otherwise the costs of making these tax-free was going to reduce revenue, and then that revenue loss was going to have to be carried in a bill.
We don't need it.
And so now we're undoing it, so this should be the exact opposite. This is math, and I'm just wondering and we're being told right now that there is no revenue raiser. It doesn't get carried.
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, I think the assumption was making them tax exempt would be a revenue loss. I think the assumption is not making them tax exempt gets us back to the base level. And in the longer term, there may be some tax revenue. We don't have a number on that.
Representative Garofalo, when the amendment is adopted, that eliminates a problem that we found out late yesterday afternoon. We received a revenue note that's in your packets, and there would have been a tail cost of $25.4 million, and I think that's in the packets. Yeah. That came in late yesterday afternoon, and so the amendment that's now before us would eliminate that tax provision that's incorporated in the amendment. Is that correct?
No,
that's
okay. A seven.
Excellent. Well, then so. We need to move A-15 then.
So,
after this one. Oh, then A-15. When we move that one, eliminates the tax question. Okay, my error.
And so, very Mr. good. Chairman, if I may.
Yeah.
And so,
Representative Graffel.
So, I think you can understand. The assumption is that by creating this benefit set, and now making it subject to taxation, there's not going to be a revenue consequence, which would mean that every single person who's going to access this program is currently working in the exact amount, hours and wages. That doesn't add up, especially the fact that when we were excluding these from taxation, there was a revenue loss. And I'm just trying to, because that revenue was being tracked in the jobs bill before, and now that revenue loss we're saying doesn't exist. And that doesn't, This is math. This is not a Garofalo problem. So
I can't speak for the tax committee, but tonight I think they're going to have a discussion on that that very issue, because it was a revenue note, and of course revenue notes go to the tax committee, and they're very aware of the problem that it creates in the tails of roughly $25 million, a little better than $25 million. So that bill will probably, once they take care of that amendment, because this committee has to certify it, so the jobs bill will probably be coming back to us sometime soon for certification purposes, because we didn't know about that revenue note until, well, I think I found out late, quite late afternoon yesterday. So it was just one of those things that came in late.
And Mr. Chairman, again, I know we're just talking about the general fund impact right now. There's a lot of other revenue outside of the general fund in this bill.
And just one bit of additional information, we are trying to watch tails as much as possible, and that would have created a major tail for some committee to carry. And I don't see anybody stepping up to the plate to carry a $25 million tail at this point. Or at any point, probably.
Mr. Chairman, I think at the end of this session, a lot of tails are going to need to get carried out of here. I don't dispute that at all. So
we're here today, and we'll worry about later.
So on the A14 amendment, then, so what this is doing is it's lowering the tax rate or the premium or whatever the word is we call it. It's lowering that, and then it's making sure that the general fund appropriations, this is the A14 amendment, the general fund appropriations are being canceled out of it. We're not carrying it in two separate bills, right? Yeah. Thank you.
Yes. Okay. Any other questions or comments about the bill? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Halverson, on lines 1.5 through 1.8 of the A14 amendment, you are adjusting the qualifications for private plans. And I'm wondering if you can elaborate in terms of on page or on line 1.5, it says may provide shorter durations. So the words matter. So when you say shorter durations, what is meant by that in terms of a objective understanding that an employer might seek a safe harbor from?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, as per previous conversations, many employers, especially large employers, tend to carry some type of private plan for paid family leave. We've established that it makes employers very competitive in a very tight labor market. And so employers who have the scalability in order to provide such benefits typically do to make themselves competitive. They may not match up exactly with what is being proposed for the state plan. And so we're not asking for an apples to apples exact private plan. What we want to ensure is that wage replacement is equitable. And so that is what this gets to. And so if an employer has a 8-week leave plan at 100% wage replacement, and that would exceed what is required by the state plan, they would be eligible to continue their private plan to provide as much flexibility for employers as possible.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Halverson. So we're still at the meeting or exceeding, so it's either, is it the dollar amount or the number of weeks that would qualify for the exemption from being in the state plan?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, the amendment states that you can have a shorter duration of leave and benefits as long as the wage replacement is equal.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Halverson. I think I know where you're going, but in a sense then, what you're suggesting is it's a bit of coercion, because either you accept the state plan at 12 weeks plus 12 weeks plus, as I see in the language, another 26, or you go out and you buy a plan through the private markets of similar or better benefit set, and then you obligate the employer and the employee to pay for it. So there is, you're taking away the competitive advantages that an employer has to work with their employees to make it workable for them. It's really just narrowing what opportunities they have to work within the confines of their own employment and their own employer. So Members, for that, I would oppose this amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, to clarify, the if a private plan is being offered, the employer and employee are not paying the premium in the bill. So it's not a – you're not paying for two plans. You're paying for one.
Well, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Halverson, my suggestion is that you're not playing for two plans, but you're obligating an employer to pay for something that they might have other means of taking care of, whether that be job sharing, whether that be through other means that the employer and the employee and an arrangement that they have taken care of, you allow them to work out the details that are work best for them and their workplace, as opposed to obligate them to either provide a plan that they find, which might obligate them to higher costs, or we have to go into the state plan, which obligates them under very specific criteria for what they have to provide. So it just narrows the opportunity for an employer to do what he feels right by his employees and still be productive and provide the jobs for those employees.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I was sitting down in a tax committee, and I just want to make sure I have this right. So we're on the A-15 amendment that would...
We're on the A-14 amendment, which is an author's amendment.
Okay, I guess my question would be the A-15. So I'll pass, Mr. Chairman.
Let's see, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Halverson... kind of some of Representative Albright's questions around this, and I haven't read the entire bill, and I'm still coming up to speed on what the bill does and how it works, but the language that is here, so could an employer say in their replacement package that they have for their employees, could it say 1 day and the full amount of their benefits?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I think you need to clarify that question. Full amount of what benefits?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Halverson, if you read the amendment, the wage replacement benefits, so could they have 1 day of leave and the full amount of wage replacement benefits in this language?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, the reason that these plans exist amongst employers who currently offer them exists because it provides a competitive advantage to employers. And it means that employers are trying to do right by their employees as well. And we have a number of employers in Minnesota who do have the economy of scale to lead the way and provide paid family and medical leave benefits to their employees. However, there is a huge percentage of employers who do not have that economy of scale and have asked for the ability to be equally responsive to employees' needs, to the needs for employees to care for family members, to care for themselves when they're ill, and they are not able to provide those same level of benefits in this tight labor market. That's a differentiator. And so I think we can talk a lot about different hypotheticals, but that is not a hypothetical that any employer in the state of Minnesota has brought to me with regard to what they offer for private plans. Employers are trying to do right by their employees, and so that's not a hypothetical that has been brought to me by any employer in the state.
Mr. Representative Skowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Halverson, I agree with you. Employers without government intervention can work just fine and provide these added benefits if they believe it's something that works well for them and puts them at a competitive advantage with quality employees. But we're writing this into law. We are taking the decision, the power, the authority away from the employers and telling them they have to do these things. And so you are writing into law an amendment here that says they can go with a shorter duration of leave and as long as the amount of total wage replacement benefits is the same. So my question is, can an employer pay all those wage replacement benefits back with 1 day of leave? That's a yes or no question under the language in the amendment.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dostowski, I'm just going to say again, this amendment puts in place the flexibility for employers to provide a private plan that works for them. It's also, to be very clear, if employers have a short-term disability policy, which many employers do, but do not have the ability to offer a family leave benefit, they can get the family leave benefit through these very low premiums to the state and pay into the state plan and get that benefit for their employees. Minnesotan employees leave about almost $400 million of wages on the table every year. And this is really about making sure that we make sure that employers can compete for employees in ways that work for them, provide them the flexibility, and this has been something that Minnesota employers are asking for, the ability to share risk with other employers so that they can offer these kinds of benefits. And large employers who have kind of led the way and blazed a trail and added these benefit sets want the flexibility to continue, and this amendment provides them both.
So, Mr. Chair?
Representative Dostowski, and if I might just interject, members, we passed this bill yesterday as part of the jobs bill. I'm willing to entertain questions, but just remind people that it's already been moved out of committee. This is a second run at it. So continue to ask your questions, but just so people understand that it's already over in Texas.
Well, thank you.
If I could just interject really quickly. Mr. Chairman, if I could just interject very quickly, my apologies. But I think many of us I don't want to speak for every member on this side of the aisle, but we saw that this bill was calendared, and we anticipated that rather than having the jobs debate be about a very large policy of finance, we thought today was going to be the debate on this bill. So that's may why it be why you didn't hear anything on
that. Well, I've been entertaining the questions. So I just wanted to remind people that it's...
Thank you.
Well, and I will offer...
I think Representative Halverson just... This is... With this amendment, aligns it with what's before the tax committee. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, the A-15 amendment is going to go on in taxes as well with the...
But I mean, as far as the what we're identifying as the A-14 amendment, the author's amendment, is aligning it with what's in taxes currently, if I recall. And then we'll be dealing with the tax provision separately with another amendment. But, okay, well, at any rate, Representative Vogel was next.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Dostowski, you still had another one. Okay.
Yeah, thank you. Before I was interrupted, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this is the first time we've seen this amendment, I think. I mean, this is brand-new language before the committee. We haven't seen this before.
I think, Representative Dostowski, that was the question I was asking Representative Halverson. Was this language in the bill that we passed yesterday as part of the jobs bill?
Mr. Chair, no, it was not. Okay. This is new language. And this came out of a discussion. This is my response to a discussion that we had in the state government finance to provide more employer flexibility.
Okay, that clarifies it then. It is new language. So, Representative Dostowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, obviously, Representative Halverson doesn't want to ask a question, and the answer, according to the language, is yes. An employer, according to this language, could pay back the whole wage replacement benefit package with one day of leave. There's nothing in here or anywhere that's been refuted to say that it's anything different in the bill or any references. So it appears to me that this is not about leave and having parents home with their kids. It's about an entitlement to a wage replacement benefit that is something that is extracted in this bill from employers and enforced in the employer-employee relationship with the due force of government. And that's what we're doing here, members. With this amendment and the language, the emperor has no clothes, and we can see that this is really about creating an entitlement for employees and having government dictate the employee-employer relationship. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hey, Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is lines 1.5 to 1.8 on the amendment. Looking at page 16, where it talks about benefits, section 12, and the benefits are weighted relative to a person's income level, giving more income to apparently people that have a lower wage than a higher wage. So the question is to the author is, how are you going to calculate what would qualify for your amendment?
Mr. Chair and Representative Vogel, there is an application that employers would fill out with the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and that's who would make the determination regarding the private plans and the making sure that the private plans follow the letter of the law. And so it's about equal replacement of wages. Because the higher wage employees claw back about 55% of their wages, there are many private plans that exist already that are higher, particularly when it comes to short-term disability, not necessarily with paid family leave, but with short-term disability policies. And those private plans will continue to be sold. Many of those private plans pay out at a higher wage replacement. As I've talked to employers, they tend to pay out at 85% of wages or all the way up to 100% of wages. And so if that is their choice and that is what they're doing for their employees, they should be able to continue with those private plans, and this provides them the flexibility to do so.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, but I guess the concern I have as an employer is if I look at that, I could calculate one day in time relative to this Section 12 what that payment would be. But if I replace an employee at a different salary level the next day, now I'm out of compliance, and that's why I'm wondering what's in the amendment that allows us to definitively get your exemption. In other words, if I turned in the numbers today and my employee base changes tomorrow, am I out of compliance so I have to do a daily reporting? Or how does this amendment work? Because you're talking about a dollar amount, and the only way the dollar amount, as I can see, can be calculated is under Section 12. So what is the plan here to exempt people and to know that they are exempted empirically relative to the calculation that's going on in Section 12?
Mr. Chair and Representative Vogel, it's about the percentages of wages. And so if your private plan pays out at 100% of wages and the state plan pays out at 55, you can figure based on the number of weeks the benefits are available if your plan is comparable. If you have an 8-week plan that pays out at 85%, your employees would fall into that 55% wage category. You can do the math to figure out if 12 weeks at 55% is greater than or less than 8 weeks at 85%. So you're right, it is a math problem, but it's not an impossible math problem. It has to do with the length of the benefit and the wage replacement during that benefit period.
So, Mr. Chair, and to the author, do I then have to assume that if I'm going to have a plan, that it has to mirror the exact benefits here so that I can say that it's the comparable benefits? I'm getting at you're saying the total dollar amount, but I'm saying how do we come up with the total dollar amount? Because you've got flexibility here relative to the employment base.
Representative Oliverson.
Mr. Chair, the calculation would be what your private plan is. So, again, we'll say 8 weeks at 85% wage replacement, and then you compare that to what your employee base is. If you have an employee base that pays out based on the wage replacement, you can do that calculation and compare. This is a 12-week benefit set at 55 to 90% of wage replacement. If your wage replacement is comparable to that, but you have a shorter duration of leave, then you would be able to continue at with your private plan.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Vogel,
so in the fiscal note, it assumes, though, less than 12 weeks for each one of those different categories. Does that mean then the employer uses those number of weeks relative to collect to their calculation, or are they responsible for the entire maximum?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, the fiscal note assumptions are based on utilization of the benefit. And so comparable benefits would be what the maximum would be that you could carry out in each of those categories. Because we know that most people don't take 12 weeks of leave. Most employees don't. And so the assumptions with the fiscal note are based around the fact that most people don't actually take that leave. And it kind of, you can see the way it plays out in our workplaces today. I mean, look at how much sick time and vacation time Minnesotans leave on the table with their employers. And so this is about meeting needs for employees and employers and providing employers the flexibility to continue their private plans.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I still look at this as an employer. I know that if I want to opt out, I'm going to have to follow this paragraph. I've got flexible benefits, and I'm assuming, I guess I can't assume. Are you saying that I would use the, to come up with a total dollar amount so that it matches 1.5 through 1.8, that I would use the entire benefit that would be payable to 12 weeks and maybe 24 weeks, or that I would use the weeks that are projected in the fiscal note, because the employer is going to have to know which one are you going to use?
The fiscal note, Mr. Chair, the fiscal note is about cost to the state. The benefits is laid out in the bill, and the way you calculate comparable benefits are about the benefit set as a whole. So if you have, if you offer all of your employees a short-term disability plan, you would be able to calculate how that plan compares with the state plan. And it's based on the benefits that are available to the employees. Now, not everybody takes short-term disability. And so, you know, you as an employer get to plan for what percentage of your employment base will take short-term disability and that. But comparing benefit set to benefit set, it's very much like if you're shopping for a benefit set. And some employers will probably do that. They'll say, here's what the premium is for the state plan. Here's what I'm paying for a private plan or could pay for a private plan. This is what the benefits are for my employees, and you compare them. It's no different.
Mr. Chair, Representative Halverson, so what I'm hearing is that I have a small business. I want to opt out. I have to assume the full benefit, the 12 weeks or the 24 weeks or whatever it is, if I'm going to apply, because that's the only thing that's going to be accepted, because you're saying that I have to come up with comparable benefits that would pay the same amount. And the same amount comparably for the whole thing would be 12 weeks. So I, as a private employer, would have to come up with 12 weeks, but we're assuming in the fiscal note that government is only going to be stuck with 6 weeks of payments because that's what the fiscal note says. Am I wrong in that assumption from what you're saying, that I would have to have 12 weeks figured to exempt myself from this program to do my own internal one?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, the amendment states that you can have a shorter term duration plan as long as the income replacement is the same.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I appreciate that. And you just said the total amount, basically. As long as the total payout is the same, we're okay adjusting the duration. But to get to the total payout, I'm going to have to know how much that payout would be. So if I have to calculate it off of the 12 weeks with this schedule that I just said, that's the dollar amount I come up with. Now, if I come up with $5,000 for an employee and I want to cut the duration back from 12 weeks to 6 weeks, I just pay that over a faster period of time, and I understand that. But you still have to know how much you're paying at the end to be able to compare it. Otherwise, you know, how are you going to figure this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, the same way you buy any other wage replacement plan, if you're going to buy a short-term disability plan, you know what the value of the plan is for each employee. It's no different.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think we've figured it out yet, and I'd also speak against this amendment because I really think it's not ready yet to put into law and have an employer try to follow it.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Bijan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Halverson. Just a couple. So as I'm going through this, there will be a cost to employers. Is that correct? Is that what the assumption is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kreisha, if employers want to provide a private plan, they can provide their private plan. If they want to provide a public plan, they can pay a very low premium and get benefits for their employees.
Okay. So there will probably be a cost to employers. School districts are not exempt, right? They're considered an employer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kreisha, they are employers.
Okay, so, and I just want to walk this through. So we're going to increase the cost to school districts. And the other thing that, as I look at this, we haven't accounted for what that cost will be on the fact that we provide the whole budget to school districts for the revenue. So it doesn't seem like that was calculated in. Certainly didn't come through the Ed Finance Committee, so I don't know that we had that discussion. But the other thing that, and this is a problem that I'm seeing, is we're saying to employers, and school districts are employers, that they can pick how they want to put these plans together. However, school districts are governed by a different set of laws, especially the Health Insurance Transparency Act, the PEEP rules, and whether or not they self-insure. Has all of that been factored in? You have large school districts that self-insure, they're an employer, but yet they could be governed as to whether or not, because self-insured districts are carved out, they can do whatever they want. Smaller rural schools are governed by the Health Insurance Transparency Act, where they have to go out and get a minimum number of bids, they have to work with service co-ops, and they have to seek a PEEP bid, public employer. So all of this, I mean, we keep talking about employers, 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 and there's this overlying assumption of private. However, this is a huge impact to our school districts, and I just want to point that out. I'm not trying to make any judgment calls and all that, but I do not think this has been thought through. It has, at least on the school district side. I don't know that the school districts know what's coming. And I look at all the committees this has come through, and, Mr. Chair, this has not come through Ed Finance. Just bringing that up, that's a conversation we could have had or should have. I'm assuming there's an impact. So, you know, I'm, again, just throwing it out there. We talk about the school district budgets and all that. This is a fairly large nugget that's going to impact their budgets. Those are my comments, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Kreisha. As we saw this winter, climate change is having a big impact on schools, but we're not taking the education finance bill through Chair Wagenius's Energy and Climate Committee as much as I don't know she might like. You're right, school districts are employers. We're establishing, I think, actually kind of one level for all employers in the state that you can arrive at through two different paths, if I'm understanding this amendment. You know, you can choose a private path to that if you're currently doing that and you prefer that, or you can choose the public path, and if you prefer that, if either you're not providing this benefit to your employees or you prefer that path because it's less expensive, what we're doing is we're making sure that whether a woman is an auto mechanic, a secretary, an actuary, a school teacher, a paraprofessional, or a lunch lady, when she has a child, she's able to take time off of work. And we're ensuring that and be able to do that not just because the employer will provide time, but that her family can financially afford that. And we're making sure that a guy who has a sick mother who needs care or a sick child or for their own health needs to take time off can do that, whether they're an auto mechanic or a secretary, or an actuary, or a teacher. I don't know that every bill needs to go through every committee, but I believe Chair Halverson is approaching the record for this biennium, this session, as to how many committees a single bill can come through.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Halverson.
This is my ninth committee stop. We've had incredible testimony and discussion at every single stop along the way. And I hear a lot of concern about the negative impact of this. Some of the testimony that we have heard clearly shows that the benefits to paid family medical leave far outweigh the costs. the problems that we're trying to solve as a state, and this committee is seeing all of these questions being brought to them. How do we make sure that we are getting people into the workforce? In California, when paid family leave went into place, the workforce participation among women increased 10 to 17% across the state. When we are desperately searching for people to fill positions in our schools, in our nursing homes, in long-term care settings, not to mention the holes that exist within manufacturing sectors and technology sectors, we have a workforce shortage crisis that we are trying to solve as a state. In addition, we have a caregiving crisis that we are trying to solve as a state, and we are using tremendous state resources to try to solve that caregiving crisis. We don't have enough people taking on caregiving as a profession, and we have a lot of family members who say, I want to participate in my loved one's caregiving. We heard testimony from a woman who's has a 35-year-old husband who has been diagnosed with a glioblastoma. That is the cancer that killed Senator John McCain. We know how fatal it is. We know how short her time is with her husband. She would give anything to have time with her husband. She does not have a paid family leave program that allows her to be home caregiving for her spouse. Instead, that's happening with caregiving professionals so that she can be at work maintaining their benefits and bringing home a paycheck. There's nothing she wouldn't give for that time. Would she give 0.3% of 0.3 of 1% of her paycheck in order to have that time, she would. Would we love to see our caregiving crisis get to be solved in part by free caregivers who are love the person they're caring for more than anybody in the world? Absolutely. This is what families are asking for. Would we want to make sure that people get to heal at home so that we don't have an increase in hospital rehospitalizations, which paid family leave has a direct impact on readmissions to hospitals, because if people are going back to work before they're ready, if people are working while they're having chemotherapy when they should not be being exposed to pathogens, when women, a quarter of all women go back to work within 2 weeks of giving birth in this state. We have a tremendous, we put our health at risk, and that has a direct cost to our state. So all the questions that all of your committees are trying to solve, this bill has an impact. This bill has an impact on trying to solve those financial problems for our state. That is why I've seen so many committees, and that's why we've heard testimony on the impact on the labor force, and that's why we've heard testimony on the direct cost implications with regard to saving money in our healthcare system. And that's why we hear about what it means for families to get to be able to take time off to care for their loved ones. So the human and economic benefits are nearly incalculable.
Okay, we have the amendment, the 814, before us. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, since my name
this
was
is an amendment to the bill, we've been discussing the bill quite a bit, but all right, if on the amendment, I think we're going to have to be sure people are focusing
sure.
on
sure, and all I want,
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All my point was, as Representative Halverson said, this is still an economic benefit. Our only constitutional job is to balance a budget. How things move through the spreadsheet is our job, folks. This amendment fixes that, or at least goes after some parts of that. We move numbers in a spreadsheet. My point, and I just need to bring this up, was not to say whether or not it was a good idea or a bad idea to go through Ed Finance, but we didn't. We didn't. And I'm just saying we need to calculate the benefits of these and allow a heads up to all entities, schools included, so they can plan for the economic benefits that Representative Halverson is talking about. That's my only point.
Okay, any further discussion on the amendment? Okay, seeing none then, in favor of the A14 amendment, signified by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. We'll now go to the A15, or first of all, the A13 amendment, will be withdrawn. The language in the A13 amendment was incorporated in the A14 amendment. So the chair will move that we'll move the A15 amendment, which deletes the section making the benefit tax exempt from the bill. And that's the reference that I made earlier, that we had an earlier discussion on, that created a big tails problem of about $25.4 million. And so the author has agreed that we will remove that section. So any discussion? Representative Garofalo.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman and members, so what we have before us now is that when the government, when we have to account for the cost of things, we're going to take care of those costs. But the other costs we're going to impose on the, we're going to employers, employees. So I want a roll call on this amendment, and I want to find out who thinks that we should be paying taxes on these benefits or not, because it seems counterintuitive to the stated purpose of the goal, stated goal of this bill. Thank you.
Okay, any further discussion? Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, I was down in taxes. Now I'm here. And so what is the motion before us at this point?
There's a provision, Representative Davids, in the bill that makes the benefits tax exempt. And that, even though it was perhaps a good idea, it carries a tail of about $25.4 million. And so currently, by the way, these provisions are taxed. And so by adopting the amendment, then we solve the tail problem.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I wasn't very clear. Let's back up a little bit. What's the motion that brought this bill before the committee? Where is this bill supposed to go is what I'm trying to ask.
When this amendment is adopted, it makes it clears the way for the bill to go to the House floor.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would respectfully disagree. This bill has to go to taxes. In fact, Representative Halverson agreed in labor that it should go to taxes. If you pass this amendment, all we're doing is taking out Section 30, I believe. Or what is it? We're taking out 30. Mr. Chairman, I would draw your attention to new language on page 29 that talks about FICA taxes, new language for FICA taxes, old age survivors taxes, disability insurance taxes. The Department of Revenue administers it, and there's a fiscal note for the Department of Revenue. How in the world could this not go to taxes? But I'm glad that Chair Halverson had agreed that it should go to taxes. So is the motion right now to go to taxes or to general register?
The motion that is before us right now would be to place the bill on the general register. If this amendment doesn't go on, you're correct, it would have to go to taxes, but that's why the amendment is before you.
Well, I understand, Mr. Chairman, that the motion is that it goes to taxes. I believe it was a Liebling motion, and, of course, Liebling and Davids generally agree on things, and I certainly want to support the Liebling motion here, but whether the amendment goes on or not, if you remove this, it still has to go to taxes because you've changed the tax status of the bill. You're going from it not being taxable to it being taxable, which is a terrible, terrible thing to make this thing taxable, but I understand why you have to do it. So regardless if this amendment passes or doesn't, and I'm sure it's going to pass, it still has to go to taxes. There's a fiscal note. You go to page 29, disability insurance tax, FICA, Department of Revenue administers, a tax of 0.65, a tax of 0.5265. Did I mention it goes to the Department of Revenue? And then you go to the next page, it says that it goes to the Department of Revenue, and this is all stuff that we're not touching. We're not touching this. Collection of premiums goes to the Commissioner of Revenue, and the premium in this case is a tax. And, okay, now we have an amendment to say that it's not taxed. And probably a bigger part here as to why it goes to taxes, employers around the state, school districts around the state are going to be paying bazillions of dollars for this. It adds great expense to their bottom line. What can that company do with those taxes they're paying? They can deduct them. Is that a good idea? I don't know. Hadn't been a tax committee. This bill, I don't know how one can say, even if this amendment passes, that it doesn't go to taxes. Of course it goes to taxes. You're going from tax-free to taxable. And then page 29. I mean, my gosh, Chair Lencheski taught me well.
If it goes to taxes, it goes to taxes. This, I don't know how we can get around. It looks like you're trying to get around this going to taxes, but you got tax deductible for the taxes that are being paid. That's deductible. The premium or the benefits to the employee are now taxable, which is awful if you think about it for 5 seconds. So now they're taxable benefits. Has that been through the tax committee? Well, it better be. And then go to page 29. I just started reading this thing. There's probably a lot more reasons. Yeah, page 28. FICA taxes, disability. This is all new language. This is not existing law. This is new language here. Benefits, did I mention that the Commissioner of Revenue administers this? Did I mention there's a fiscal note? How could this possibly not go to taxes? The A15 amendment is not something that gets us to not go to taxes. And taxes is fun. I would think somebody would want to come to taxes. So, Mr. Chair, I hope you'll reconsider. I think the motion before us is to go to taxes. As always, I would support Chair Liebling to the wall on this. And so, members, this has to go to taxes.
Members, I obviously have a little different take on this, but I think many of your arguments, perhaps not all of them, Representative Davids, would have been when we get to the point of passage of the bill. Right now we have the amendment that strikes the section that deals clearly with taxes. If you look, members, at Rule 4.10, paragraph C, the last sentence, for purposes of this paragraph, tax excludes any fee, charge, exaction, or assessment, a primary purpose of which is to recover direct or indirect costs incurred by the state or other government entity or as payment for benefits received. So my interpretation of this language is that if this amendment does go on, that the bill is cleared then to go to the general register and does not have to go to taxes. Any further discussion?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, I can read this too and just flip it on its head. Okay, so this piece still needs to go to taxes because it's dealing with how it's taxed. Is it taxable or not taxable? It goes from being not taxable in a horrific way to being taxable. So these people that are on their family leave are going to lose a boatload of money because it's being taxed. There's a fiscal note. There's a fiscal note. Fiscal note. There's many, many pages that deal with taxes here. So I would argue that I would suggest that even if the A15 amendment is passed, which is a terrible amendment, if that's passed, it still needs to go to taxes because you're just switching it from non-taxable to taxable. That's a tax issue. That's a tax issue. It's tax deductible, the taxes people are paying on this. 29, it's got, and Chair Halverson's word that this would go to taxes, which I take her at her word, that's what she said, that it would go to taxes. So, Mr. Chairman, I think you need to reconsider your thoughts on this one.
Just one quick comment. That's current law, that these benefits would be taxed. So, the chair's interpretation is that if this amendment goes on, that it need not go to taxes and go to the general register. So any further discussion? Seeing none, then, all those in favor of the A15? Roll call was requested. Okay.
On the A15 amendment, Representative Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Garofalo?
No.
Representative Albright?
No.
Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Representative Davids?
No.
Representative Dabney?
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski? No, gone. Sorry. Representative Eklund?
Aye.
Representative Hamilton?
No.
Representative Hansen?
Yes.
Representative Hausman?
Yes.
Representative Hertas? Representative Hornstein?
Yes.
Representative Kreisha?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Lilly?
Yes.
Representative Long?
Yes.
Representative Mariani?
Aye.
Representative Marquardt.
Yes.
Representative Nelson. Representative Neuer.
Yes.
Representative Pawlowski.
Aye.
Representative Poppy.
Aye.
Representative Knocker.
No.
Representative Scott. Okay. Representative Torkelson.
No.
Representative Vogel.
No.
Representative Wagenius.
Yes.
Being 17 ayes and 8 noes, the amendment is adopted. Representative Liebling, would you care to renew and modify your motion?
So, Mr. Chair, since I follow instructions very well, I will move that House File 5, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the General Register.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion? Representative David.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question for my good friend, the chair of the tax committee, Representative Marquardt. Representative Marquardt, do you support tax decisions being made outside the tax committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Davids, if it involves taxes, yes. But I think provision was removed from the bill, and I think it deals with a premium taxes for...
Representative Marquardt, you just arrived in the room. I referenced that it need not go to taxes due to Rule 4.10, Paragraph C. And to be redundant, I'll just read that and see if that helps your thoughts about the question that Representative David's posed. For purposes of this paragraph, tax excludes any fee, charge, extraction, or assessment, a primary purpose of which is to recover direct or indirect costs incurred by the state or other governmental entity or as a payment for benefits received. That was part of the discussion that Representative Davids and I were having, and so then you know the question that posed of you, Representative Marquardt, but that to bring you up to speed.
Well, right, and I know we've talked about this, I think, before, Rule 4.10, Paragraph C is what you just read, right? So if it's a, you know, a fee or where you're paying for something that you get back in return as a benefit, that's excluded from a tax. So I wouldn't see that part of the tax committee at this point.
Mr. Chairman,
were you done?
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Marquardt, then why are we hearing the – I would never question your decision-making. Well, I would. But why do we have the jobs bill before us tonight then? Because you could use 4-point whatever that is on that. You could use it on – why is the HHS bill – well, that's because of the provider tax. But why is the jobs bill coming to us tonight? I mean, this House File 5 has a lot more to do with taxes, and not just fees, taxes, that and the Department of Revenue administers it, than the jobs bill does.
Representative Davids, I can answer that question. I don't know if you were here at the beginning of the meeting, but I pointed out that the reason the jobs bill was referred to taxes was because of provision that we just took out of this bill. And I suspect that tonight there will be a discussion in taxes about that particular provision. I can't speak for the tax committee, but I think the jobs bill is up before taxes this evening, and decisions will be made about the future of that bill in that committee. I don't know if Representative Marquardt wants to comment or not.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's right. There was that new provision that was in that bill. So it sounds like the committee here has taken that out. So we'll probably discuss that later tonight.
Okay. Any further discussion? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we did have a very vigorous conversation about this in state government finance, and I appreciate the contributions made by Representative around the table that time. But one of the our observations that we heard from testimony in that committee hearing was from a number of education groups. And I don't see that this bill has made a stop in K-12 finance. And so if Representative Dabney would remark in terms of why his committee has not heard it, we've got a number of constituent groups that have voiced their concerns to me about the local impact that it would have as a potential unfunded impact cost. I'm wondering if there's been a local impact study requested through MMB. We've got folks in the probationary teaching situation as well as paraprofessionals. So, Representative Dabney, if you could kind of remark or elaborate in terms of why you feel this type of a benefit would not hold sway and take up some good conversation on your committee.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Albright, perhaps you were out of the room when I responded to I think that was a comment, not a question, by Representative Kreisha, but similar concerns. This bill treats schools no differently than it treats every other employer. I don't imagine that we'd bring the unemployment, the Unemployment Insurance Council bill through K-12 education. I don't imagine we'd bring the workers' compensation bill through K-12 education. I don't imagine we'd bring the transportation bill through K-12 education, although they use buses pretty commonly. I don't imagine that we'll bring this bill. There is no need to bring paid family leave through education because it doesn't treat education any differently than it does, breweries or insurance companies or restaurants or anyone else. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have not been exposed to this bill before today because it didn't go to transportation or any other committee. However, I can't help but note that within the structure of this bill is the need for computer programming. And I do have some experience in regards to the state of Minnesota and its ability to write computer programs in a timely and reasonable and functional fashion. Can you explain to me how you expect this particular effort to be so dramatically different than the recent efforts that we have engaged in here in the state of Minnesota when it comes to computer programming and facilitating the writing and or accommodation of extensive computer systems?
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, this is certainly an issue that has gotten a lot of discussion in other committees as well. And I think there's a few important things to note. One is that the state of Minnesota is involved in updating, changing, and creating IT systems almost constantly. There are hundreds of IT changes, upgrades, and creations that are happening at the state level at any given time. We have had a couple that have really not worked for the state and for Minnesotans. And so making sure that this is something that's workable for DEED is something that I've been very closely working on with them. And there's a few, Minute actually testified to the fact that there are systems that exist in other states that they'll be working with other states, that they have the ability in the bill to contract out for services and that they have the ability to work with other programs that currently exist, including the fact that we're modeling this on our very successful UI program, which is a system that the state built itself from scratch. And so that's what we are modeling it under.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, a number of points. First, our very successful UI program took 5 years to build at a time when cybersecurity was not nearly the issue it is today. So the expectation that we can build this in 2 years or so is a very high bar. What makes you think they can build this system so much more quickly than any other system we've built? And I'll get on to the other systems here in a minute.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, the conversations, certainly are ongoing. I think that the goal My personal goal is to make sure that we stay in touch and make sure that the language of the bill and the timelines that we set up in the bill are workable for testing purposes. And so if the timeline needs to change, I'm certainly open to having that conversation. But all of the agencies that have been working on this bill with me have also been at the same time working on their own timeline planning with regard to how to build this. So I can't testify on their behalf, but it's work that is already in progress.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ferguson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Halverson, first let's explore other states. Which state has successfully built and deployed a system from scratch?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, there are currently five states that have passed paid family and medical leave bills. The longest existing state program has been the state of California.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't believe that you answered my question. I said which state has successfully built a computer program that works?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I guess they're deploying their systems in ways that work for them, and our state leaders of these agencies have been in touch with those states. So I can't really, I guess, comment on the computer programs of other states.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my understanding is that there are no systems that have been built and are up and working, but we'll explore that later. Let's delve a little bit into our own history here in the state of Minnesota. I have some direct experience with the MNLARS program, which I was told by Minute and DPS would be up and running fully functional in earlier than that, but we'll go with the July of 2017 rollout date. We are now nearly 2 years beyond that date, and the system still is not fully functional. And that had been worked on for 10 years prior to its initial rollout date at a cost of well over $100 million. How does your proposal possibly sync with our experience?
Mr. Chair, I would actually look to successful programs that the state has built from scratch. One of the most successful in the country is our statewide voter registration system, which was built from scratch and then updated, and we need to update it again. The funds haven't been released, but with regard to cybersecurity, but the fact that that system was built and has proved itself to be one of the stronger systems, having been the subject of some attempted prodding by folks who were working on behalf of the Russian government. Our data and our voter information has been intact and protected, and we have one of the strongest voter registration systems in the country. And that is a state-run and created system. So successes exist as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Halverson. Well, let's go back a little further in Minnesota history to the MNSure system. And let's recall exactly how well that worked on its first attempt at running. If we have a similar experience with this program and this paid family leave process, not only are we going to burden our employers with these extra costs and responsibilities, we're going to burden them with a computer system that doesn't even work at the time it's supposed to work. I think your expectations exceed any reasonable person's evaluation of this situation here in Minnesota. And I would urge some way of adding some caution to this so that we do not end up in the same problem that we've ended up in with two very important programs that directly affect virtually every citizen here in the state of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I got the signal from Representative Garofalo that he was prepared to do a wrap-up from the minority perspective. Since then, two hands went up, so if they can just briefly comment, then we'll go to Representative Garofalo. Representative Vogel, just if you could briefly comment. I think it's time. We've got another major bill in the works.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had a number of questions, and basically they all related to the projections being done in the fiscal note. And looking at page 8 in the fiscal note, and most of the assumptions are based on the Institute for Women's Policy Research in Massachusetts. And I guess my curiosity to the author is, is that the gold standard for writing a new insurance policy, for underwriting it, is using that study? Because it's really the only reference I can see that really has anything definitive relative to the projections being made.
Mr. Chair, I think I'll ask somebody to comment on this, whoever wants to. However, what I would preface this conversation with is this particular plan, prior to all of the changes that it's gone through with stakeholder input, came about because in 2015 the Minnesota legislature passed a law, passed an appropriation to require a study, and we contracted with the University of Minnesota for this study, to study how Minnesota would create a paid family and medical leave program. Interestingly enough, the direction from the state was not if Minnesota should create a paid family leave program, but how we should create it. And so through that study, working with my testifier here, I will turn it over to her and let her talk about the modeling.
If you could identify yourself for the record, and we're trying to be brief, so thank you.
Yes. Sorry, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Deborah Fitzpatrick. I co-direct the Center on Women, Gender, and Public Policy at the Humphrey School at the University of Minnesota, and I led the research team that conducted the state's analysis in 2016. And to answer Representative Vogel's question, actually the modeling that is used in this fiscal note is the gold standard. It's a modeling software that was developed with the U.S. Department of Labor over 10 years. It is the modeling that every other state has used to estimate costs associated with these types of programs. It's a very sophisticated model that looks at leave-taking behavior, the health of the state, applies that to the workforce in a particular state, in this case Minnesota's workforce. And so, yes, I actually would argue this is the gold standard for modeling these kinds of programs.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So then I also make, how many insurance companies are you aware of that are using this modeling for their private sector products?
Ms. Fitzpatrick? It was Fitzpatrick?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not aware of particular private sector products, but again, this is the model that has been used. It does build off of the best available data in the private sector, in the entire economy, actually, looking at how different workers use leave currently and how that relates to how much pay they receive and what kinds of conditions that might be qualifying them for these types of leaves. So again, it does build on private sector experience, but again, it was developed with a variety of scholars and others across the country who have been looking at how these programs affect costs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know you want to move on with this, but
you're right on target.
Yeah. But as I look at the fiscal note, and I look at statements like total number of covered workers, it is difficult to estimate the impact and of the self-employment provisions on the total number of workers covered. Go on to the next one, opt out. We have no way of estimating the number of employers who will be eligible to opt out of this program. Uptake rates. Using these figures, because they are the only estimates of uptake rates available to the department, we are not able to estimate the impact. Average benefit. The department used the study again for estimates, and the reason I asked how many insurance companies are using this, because we as a state, as we found out with MNLARS or MNSURES, have what unfortunately an endless source of revenue and call the taxpayer. But if insurance companies aren't relying on this data, why should we? And that was the question. How many insurance companies have actually put together a product using this data?
Mr. Chair and Representative Vogel, Professor Fitzpatrick testified to, and I think it's a significant notation, is that the modeling was developed for populations beyond an individual employer. This is about a statewide program, and this modeling was developed on a system that models statewide employer data and statewide health data. It's not designed to be an individual employer modeling system.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll acquiesce because I know time is short, but I do think that these questions need to be answered before this bill can go farther, because we're looking at a program here. Minlar's only cost us a little over $120 million. This thing is looking at over $1 billion a year once it gets up and running. So if we're going to go into this thing, I think we need good hard estimates rather than and good hard underwriting rather than just using a study, which I'm not saying is a bad study, but doesn't seem like the private sector is confident enough to come up with a product relative to the study. Thank you.
I suspect the discussion will continue beyond today's meeting. Representative Albright, and then
I'll pass.
Okay, then Representative Garofalo, if you want to wrap it up from the minority perspective, and then we'll vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members, for this debate on this. Especially want to thank my colleague, Representative Vogel, for highlighting some of the items in the fiscal note. Whenever you have a fiscal note of this size and you have phrases like, we don't know, we can't figure out, there's no way to ascertain, that should be concerning. First of all, members, is that this issue, both sides of the aisle share the same objectives. Okay? There is no pro-constituency group for sending sick people to work. Everyone wants to see paid leave expanded. Everybody wants to see us remove barriers, create incentives, make it easier for more people to have the paid benefits that many Minnesotans already have. The question is, how do you do it? Now, there's 1,000 different ways to solve this issue, but the DFL has chosen the big government, high tax, command and control, do what we say model to impose this on Minnesota workers and on Minnesota employers. 400. That's the number of new state employees that are going to be needed just to administer the program. 400. No flexibility in terms of, we've talked about this before in terms of what is the, how do people opt out of this? If they like their benefits, how do they keep it? Well, yeah, you can opt out of it if you just do what the government says. That's your way of doing it. And this is a complete choice by the DFL. You have an opportunity to work on something that there's strong bipartisan consensus on. But what happens? The command and control government takeover model that's going to impose a solution on people is the pathway that goes forward, and it's why nothing is going to happen on this issue this year. And I suspect that even if the DFL was in total control of the state of Minnesota, it's highly unlikely this is the bill you would actually be passing. Using California as a model for legislation, it's like using Charlie Sheen as a model for personal responsibility. Okay? California is not where we want to be looking for our guidance on public policy. The high-tax, low-service, inefficient model of California is not the Minnesota way. The Minnesota way is flexibility, low-cost, high-performance, exceptional performance. That's what works in Minnesota. So importing these catastrophic ideas from the Western disaster of California is not where I want to see the state I live in going to. Members, what you're voting on today is building an insurance company. You're building an insurance company inside the state of Minnesota's government. And if that's not enough for you to vote against this bill, let me give you a really good reason why you should. Every member of the DFL just voted to raise taxes on who? Raise taxes on women who just gave birth. Raise taxes on those who are recovering from an illness. Raise taxes on those who are providing care for a loved one. The very groups that were supposed to benefit from this. And what did you do? You just voted to take away benefits, dollars that you're advocating for giving them. For that reason and no other reason alone, Mr. Chairman, I would urge members to vote no on this bill. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Seeing none then, Representative Liebling renews her motion that House File 5, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. We will now, thank you, Representative Halverson. We will now go to House File 2414, Representative Liebling, the Omnibus Health and Human Services bill. I'll give Representative Liebling a chance to get to the table.
Thank you.
Okay, welcome to the table, Representative Liebling and Mr. Berg. Representative Liebling, would you care to move the division report?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the Health and Human Service Finance Division report on House File 2414.
As adopted, yeah. The motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion carried. Representative Liebling, would you move the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would move that House File 2414 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Jesus. Yeah, and this was the one where we need to say as amended.
So oh.
The motion would be...
as amended, sorry, I didn't bring
House File 2414 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. Representative Liebling, you do have an amendment?
I do, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the A91 author's amendment.
Okay, the motion is before us, and if you could explain the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, with a bill of this size, of course, there's always going to be a lot of technical updates, and that is largely what is in this amendment. There are a couple of pieces of language on page 2 that were inadvertently left out previously. And then a lot of what is in here, what you'll see on pages, I think, 3 and 4 of the amendment, has to do with some updating of a couple of bills that are in the in this omnibus bill. One of them is Representative Albright's bill. Another one is Representative Poston's bill that are in here. And this is just updating. I don't know how much explanation you want of that, but these are, it's an interesting problem that we have because these are bills that extend new health benefits, insurance benefits. And under the Affordable Care Act, when we do that, the state of Minnesota has to actually pay the cost for having a new mandate on an insurance company to cover something that wasn't covered before. So some of this additional language, and I've discussed it with those authors, is intended to make sure that the taxpayer doesn't pay any more than we should be for that. So just to hone this and make sure that these payments that we may be making for these conditions that are currently being rejected for coverage, that we're paying an appropriate amount, I would say, as a simple explanation for that. And then there's some other technical changes in here that Mr. Berg could explain more, but they just have to do with kind of updating which accounts certain money comes from and some tweaks to the spreadsheet. And if members want more information on that, I think Mr. Berg from House Fiscal could discuss it.
Mr. Berg there that
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling's right that these are a variety of coding changes, missed lines, some addition on some administrative costs, some federal revenue that wasn't cut. There's about a dozen or so relatively minor changes to the numbers. I can go through them individually if you'd like, but none of them are other than corrections.
Okay, any discussion on the amendment? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Liebling, thank you for your support of the PAN-PANZAS legislation. Members, we heard this in a variety of committees, and I don't know that any one of the committee members around any one of those tables left with a dry eye. And so the amendment that you have before you, thankfully to Representative Liebling and staff's revisor's office actually contributes a very beneficial feature to the language that protects the patient, protects the parents. And I want to personally thank Representative Liebling for her guidance and help in this matter. It is truly heartfelt, and the parents I've talked to already are very appreciative of your work on this on their behalf as well, so thank you.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, then, all those in favor of the adoption of the A91 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Liebling on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, members, as you can see, this is a large bill. There's a lot in it. And You've just heard about a couple of the measures that are included in this, and I'm very happy to be able to include those because we did hear some very moving testimony about some families who buy insurance policies and then their children or they come up with have some needs that are just not covered, and we're able to, I hope, do something about that. The bill contains a lot of measures that are aimed at lowering the cost of prescription drugs, including the governor's prescription drug benefit that will bring down the cost of prescription drugs in public programs, but also there are many things in this bill, including that measure, that eventually should really help impact the cost of prescription drugs for everyone, because we know that is a big driver of health care cost. The bill also includes the governor's 20% premium discount and state-based tax credit for market stabilization. I'm talking now about the individual market, where the 155,000 or so people who are buying their insurance in the individual market have seen many of them have had a great deal of difficulty affording their insurance. The bill also repeals the sunset of the provider tax, which serves right now as to provide a lot of the funding for the Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance programs that together provide health care for about 1.2 million Minnesotans. This is supported by over 140 organizations that I was given a letter just at the beginning of the committee. I don't know if it was able to have been distributed, but this is supported by many, many organizations across our state. The bill also includes a corresponding 2% rate increase for medical assistance, which goes to 8,000 providers or so to offset the cost of the provider tax. The bill also includes many proposals that are aimed to provide people in Minnesota with better access to care, including some changes to the regulation around having an appropriate network of providers, so that when you buy an insurance policy, you are buying a promise that there will be providers there for you, and there are certain rules around that which have not been well enforced in recent years due to some resource restriction, and so we've updated that in the bill. Also, we're changing the way dental care would be paid for under our public programs. I've already mentioned what we call the pandas and pans, and by the end of this session, hopefully everybody will know what that is. That's Representative Albright's bill and also the Representative Poston's bill on ectodermal dysplasia. How about that one? You can say that fast. So that's just a few of the items. The bill goes deals a lot with health disparities, tries to improve health care for some of our minority communities. Very importantly, it contains the first increase in cash assistance in our Minnesota Family Investment Program, what we call MFIP, the first increase in 33 years, something I'm very, very proud of, and that was also in the governor's budget, and actually I know has had bipartisan support. I know there were attempts to do this as well in the last legislative session. I could probably go on and on about this bill. It has many really great provisions in it, and but I will stop there, Mr. Chair, and be happy to take questions.
Okay, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling, we talked in committee, both in policy and finance, with regard to the cuts to DWRS and the reinstatement of those under House File 168, which was chief authored by Representative Schultz. I'm just wondering if you could just kind of succinctly, in the space of time we have, tell us how that kind of rolls itself out over the course of the next several years. I know there's some inflator features, and I'm just curious particularly about those, how those would be enacted. I think it's the commissioner gets involved with those as well at some point. So if you could just explain when those increases come into play, and when would the inflation feature catch?
So Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Albright. And this has been a big issue. And if you see, look on the spreadsheet on page 9, you'll see that this is listed on line 357 of the spreadsheet. We've got the competitive workforce factor, DWRS, which stands for Disability Waiver Rate System. That's just one of our gazillion acronyms in Health and Human Services. But so Representative Schultz did the heavy lift on this, and what it does is there's been a complete really restructuring of the way we pay for these services that has come in over a number of years, and it's a pretty complicated thing to talk about in a few minutes, and I'm not even sure I really could anyway. But rates will now be based on there's an inflation factor that will be built in. There'll be an updating every 2 years instead of every five, which is something the advocates were very happy about, and it makes sense to make sure that this more closely tracks with the actual cost of labor to provide these services. The main concern in this whole area has been the workforce shortage and the fact that, you know, like in so many other areas, it's very hard to keep people when we're not paying competitive wages, and even when we are, frankly, it's going to be difficult to have workers in this area. But there is a competitive workforce factor that gives a bump. I think it's 4.2%, 3 maybe. And it's 4.7 is the bump to all of this. Every one of these rates has a lot of components to it. It's all calculated to be comparable to other kinds of work that are similar, other work that's similar, and to try to bring these folks up to a level where they can be competitive in the workforce. When we heard testimony on this in Health and Human Services Finance, we heard only positive testimony about this part, and I believe that the Senate has picked up a similar, if not the same, number in their spread. It's not the same, but I think they are picking up very much. This has been something that's been a work in progress with the Senate, I would say, to try to get something that works for everyone, knowing that if we don't do this right, we're putting this whole area on an unsustainable path with rising costs. So we have to strike the right balance between rising costs for the state and putting enough money in so that we can actually provide the care that we promise to the folks who are getting these services. Does that help?
Yes. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Liebling. That does help. I just clarify. One of the other issues that we talked a lot about this session was MA dental rates. And I see in your bill that we are increasing those. And I understand that the rates, maybe my point is, we're pushing out the rate increases until 2022. Could you verify that is true?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Albright. I don't know if that's there's been a lot of discussion. The governor has a one care proposal, which is taking all of our public programs and doing one pool for dental care, which is very different than what we've done. As you know, right now we have prepaid medical assistance for about 75% of our patients who are on our public programs. And those are all run through HMOs, which hire a dental administrator and pay various rates. So it's been very confusing. We also, about a quarter of our people are under fee-for-service, and that's paid for directly through the state. What this is doing is pulling all of these, all of this out of the HMO system, putting it all in one pool, and trying to come up with a rate system that will work better. Now, we've had a lot of discussion. The actual rates that are in the bill or the way they are doing it, I'm not exactly all in favor of. And so there's going to be continuing work. Representative Zerwas and I are committed to working together to really figure out a better system. So there's comfort language in the bill that really says we're going to keep working on this. I know not everyone's happy, but I do want to point something out. In the Senate bill actually eliminates the whole benefit for adults on our public programs. Eliminates it. So if you don't like mine, because it doesn't do enough, you're going to like theirs a whole lot less. Maybe that's not relevant today, but we are, with good faith, working together to try to figure out something that both makes sure that the essential providers who provide this care stay in business to provide it, but also makes sure that the dollars we spend, as always, actually go to help provide the care that we very much want to have provided. So we are working on this. As you know, it's often a difficult balance. We spend a lot of money in this area. Yes, we do, and we want to make sure that dental access and the results are really what they should be, and that has not been the case up till now.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I appreciate that comment, and particularly the fact that you're assuring us that we're working. I think one of the points of the conversations that we had in both health care committees over the last several months is that there was a concern that critical access rates for dental were going to be poised for a cut. And not trying to hem you in on saying yes or no, but can you just elaborate to that point and your observations in terms of we're not at the end, hopefully. There is work to do, as you said, and I hope that you'll take under thoughtful consideration our greater Minnesota healthcare access needs for dental, particularly with critical access. So happy to hear your response, but not necessary.
Right. And Mr. Chair, if I could, I was just reminded, too, in the bill also we have an additional coverage that has not been covered for a few years under medical assistance, and that is coverage of periodontal disease. So we've been educated to understand that it's not just whether your teeth are good, but your gums are important to your total health. And we have not been paying for that, I think, since we went through a big budget deficit time and we cut out a bunch of dental benefits. So that is in here. So that's an increase in the bill to that dental benefit. And then in terms of looking toward the future, I would say this, Representative Albright, I'm interested in right-sizing this so that we pay for results and we make sure that we have the providers there to provide those results. And so I can't say whether this would be up or down, because I feel like right now, we need to spend the right amount, not a dollar too much and not a dollar too little. So that's my commitment I'm going to keep working on. And if it ends up being a total overall cut, but the money's better targeted and gets better results, I would say that would be a win-win.
Representative Garofalo, you're next, but were you going to do a wrap-up or... Okay, so then Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Liebling, thank you for your work on this. I'm glad someone chairs this committee, because I don't know how anyone possibly can. This is just such a huge operation. And we'll just start at a basic level. I'm just trying to track from a revenue perspective where this stuff is going. Jeremiah? I'm just trying to track the revenue and where this is coming from, so I'm going to ask a couple of questions, and feel free to defer to nonpartisan staff at any time. So base budget was $14.8 billion. This is just general fund right now, $14.8 billion. Last year's budget was $13.4 billion, so baked into the forecast is about $1.5 billion increase, and then there's a general fund target of $128 million above that. That's the easy part. And then from there, it's tracking the transfers. We'll start with tracking the transfers into the general fund, which yield new revenue and reduce the net spending amount. And so I guess my first question would be, when the healthcare access fund transfers money into the general fund, we actually book that money being spent as general fund spending, correct?
Mr. Marks? Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, that would be general fund revenue, which would be available to be general fund spending.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just, I want to clarify, because sometimes, for example, when we talk about using the general fund to pay for transportation, well, technically it's not, because what we did was we took revenue away from the general fund and directed it into roads, and I didn't know if it was comparable to this. So in terms of transfers into the general fund, do we have an amount? So we've gone through the base funding, the higher target. Transfers into the general fund exclusively from the healthcare access fund, do we have a number on that?
Mr. Byrd?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, there in this bill are not any transfers from the health care access fund to the general fund that are new in 2021. The $122 million annual transfer that is in Chapter 16 that would not happen in fiscal 22 and 23 are restored because the fund has enough revenue because of the extension of the provider tax for that to happen. So that's the only new transfer from the health care access fund to the general fund.
Mr. Chairman, to nonpartisan staff, so the 20 and 21 base number, that includes the 122 transfer, though, for fiscal year 20 and 21.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, yes. Okay. That was in there before the restoration of the provider tax allowed, or to put it differently, on the February forecast fund balance for the health care access fund, there was not a transfer of that statutory 122 in 22 or 23 because the fund did not have enough money.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Chair, I apologize. This is going to be kind of nerd central, so if members are bored by questions, this might be a good time to go enjoy the sunshine.
We just survived the last bill, so I
think
okay.
No new health care access fund transfers in 20 and 21. Non-general fund revenue sources into the general fund. Mm-hmm. So transfers from, like, there's a chemical dependency one I saw.
Right.
Could you just give me the top three biggest ones of the total sum is of revenue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, now things that this is extra nerdy on whether it's a transfer or a general fund fee or something. So there are FFP, Federal Financial Participation, which go to the general fund and are treated in the general fund balance statement as essentially reduced spending in the human services section of the general fund. There is $14 million in new federal financial participation revenue that goes to the general fund in this bill. Then there is, maybe more than you want, when Mr. Marks does his revenue offset to the numbers he has, the FFP number is already subsumed in his number, but when I look at it here separately, we roll up those numbers individually. So it depends on which level you're sitting at, whether that number is included or not. It's included in Marx's numbers. It's not included in mine until afterwards. Then there's $170 million in 20 and 21 of non-dedicated general fund, either revenue or in some cases it can either be new revenue or it can be reduced spending. Either way is counted, and it's $170 million. Of that, $142 million is the transfer from the premium security account to the general fund. Then, to get at the items that you were talking about, there are a number of places in this bill and in the governor's budget that transfer money from dedicated funds to the general fund. The largest of those items is the refinancing of what's probably members would, if they've heard of it, would think of as the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund. There is a general refinancing of the way that service is done, and it isn't treated anymore as basically a fund which builds up a balance in it. So that transfers a number in the neighborhood of $50 million in 20 and 21 into the general fund, but then respends a sizable portion of it in changing the way the benefit is provided. There are also, the next largest one, I think, would be in the direct care and treatment specialty health care system that is run for clients in the direct care and treatment. There's a transfer from dedicated funds there, basically enterprise fund money, to the general fund. And I'm sorry, that doesn't come to me off the top of my head. I think it's in the neighborhood of $10 million. I could look it up later. And then there's a whole variety of other things in here that you might see. For instance, cost of care when we there's an additional expenditures in here, for instance, for staffing in the sex offender program. Because counties pay a portion of the cost of the sex offender program, when the spending goes up on that, there is what we call cost of care recoveries, and there's additional revenue from those people who pay a portion of the cost. In this case, I think about $3.4 million comes into the general fund coffers as the share that the counties pay gets, the percentage is the same, but the percent it's a percentage of a larger number. And then after that, there are just a whole series of lesser both additions and subtractions, to either spending of new revenue or new revenue in some cases.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, or again, our nonpartisan staff, can you explain what TANF refinancing is and how that's working in this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, there really is only one thing related to TANF in this bill. In the item that Representative Liebling talked about, the increase in the MFIP cash grant, the portion, the way the TANF fund is planned is that there is a four-year plan to spend down all the money. We get a $260 million grant from the federal government each year, which goes into the TANF reserve fund. There are a variety of uses. The tax committee gets a certain portion of it. Some of it is used in child care. Some of it is used in the MFIP cash grant. Some of it is used for support services grants, which are really a housing benefit. And there is a plan to spend down to the end of the following biennium. So in the upcoming biennium and the following biennium, all the money is assumed to be spent. It's a state-federal partnership. The state spends what it has to on each of these programs, and we assume federal spending so that we spend up all of the federal money. But as in any forecasted situation, each time you go to a forecast, you were wrong, and so there is a difference in it. The February forecast showed that at the end of the four-year period, there would be a $3.5 million unspent amount of TANF, which the governor's plan for the MFIP cash benefit pumps in the first year and spends. And so it offsets the state's share of the cost of the $100 increase by spending what's left of the TANF fund in the forecast, and then makes the same assumption that the balances are spent down over the four-year time horizon to zero. Now, next forecast, those numbers will again be wrong, and there will need to be adjustments down the road. But as of the February forecast in this bill, the $3.5 million of excess TANF funds in the forecast gets spent in 2020 on the MFIP cash benefit item.
And Mr. Chairman, and again to Representative Liebling or staff, so we have a target in this committee of $15 billion, and I understand it's a net spending amount. Do we have a general fund gross spending number that I could look to? When I look through the spreadsheets, and some of the other committees, and I know healthcare is different, but other committees, you're able to see like a net spending target, and there's a revenue target above it, and there's a gross spending number you can figure out from that. In between the shots of the game last night, I may or may not have been able to find that information. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, the number you're talking about doesn't appear in the spreadsheet, although the net spending number, there is a reconciliation to target calculator on the top that shows the net number you referred to. You could add up, of course, the sections of the bill, but I have a supplemental sheet that I use that shows the let me find the correct sheet. Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, the gross general fund spending for 2021 is $15,255,431,000, according to my calculator.
Mr. Chairman, and to, again, Representative Liebling, or the staff, and Representative Liebling, I can just see her. She wants to jump into this.
I just want to tell you that there will be a test.
Yeah, well, and I will fail. So the general fund portion of the premium security account, that is included in that number as a revenue stream. I'm asking that and making this a statement. Is that included in that number?
In Mr. Chairman, Representative Garofalo, it's not part of the gross general fund spending number, no. It nets out against the spreadsheet. I mean, that is, it's an offset to general fund spending because the bill spends $15,255,000,000, and then there are credits to the general fund that offset that number to get to the net. One of them would be the $142 million transfer.
So, Mr. Chairman, and to Representative Liebling and to the non-part the testifiers, so that 15,255, if I'm looking at, and I understand why we have a general fund target and stuff, that's really my general fund number if I'm looking at the spend. From my perspective, I'm not saying it's more right or more wrong, but for someone who's looking at including both the non-tax revenue as well as the general fund impact, that's the number I should be looking at? Or is there a general fund, is there some other general fund spending going on in there that I'm not seeing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, you are talking about two numbers. So there is an appropriation of $15,255,000,000 in this bill. Then there are revenues to the general fund that offset that number and bring it down to the $15,003,000,000 number.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, just pivoting now to the healthcare access fund. And I've got a summary page from you that I think is accurate. I just want to state what this is. Removing the provider tax repeal, or removing the sunset of the provider tax. The spreadsheet I'm looking at here shows fiscal year 20 impact of $236 million, fiscal year 21 of $733 million. I just want to make sure the information I have is what I think it is. Is that the accurate numbers for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, that's correct. I realize after I pass this along to you today that it isn't exactly correct because it does not take into account the author's amendment here or the author's amendment in Human Services Finance on Friday, but those only affected the spending at DHS and the Department of Health. The revenue portions you're looking at are the governor's numbers and what are done in this bill.
And so, Mr. Chairman, and to Representative Liebling as well as staff, so the revenue into the health care access fund is the repeal of the sunset for the provider tax, and then there's the premium security account transfer of the portion that was financed by the healthcare access fund. What other transfers are there into the healthcare access fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, there are no other transfers to the healthcare access fund. It's in the 2021 biennium. It's the approximately $1.36 billion that you identify.
Okay. And so how about in 2223?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, it's that same, the provider tax numbers carried on. It's $771 million in 22 and $809.3 million in 23.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, this is one actually Representative Liebling I will know like to answer. Historically, and it doesn't really matter who's in charge of this place, what ends up happening is the health care access fund ends up being used to fund the education budget and the general fund. That's what's been happening for years. Now, people will say that it's not being used for that, but that's what happens, is that at the end of session, when there's an amount of solution that needs to be provided, general fund revenue sources are provided. Usually they're not tax increases, but the healthcare access fund ends up being a revenue source to the general fund, which is then used to pay for a higher target in the education arena. When I made that statement, you kind of looked at me like you were skeptical of that. I didn't think there was a debate on it, but I guess I'll let you respond. I thought it was a fact, but maybe you think it's an opinion if you want to respond to that.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, I mean, money is fungible, right? So, you know, a dollar that you don't have to, I guess you could say that. I mean, by the same token, when Republicans took $400 million out of the health care access fund to fund reinsurance, I guess that allowed you to use the other money for other stuff. So, yeah, I guess so.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I wasn't trying to, lob an accusation or be confrontational. I was legitimately saying that I think a concern that this sector has is that the healthcare access fund is continually used to subsidize activities in the general fund. And just as someone who tracks the numbers at the end of session, you know, the education number always goes up. It always goes up faster than when it comes to finding a solution and individual budget targets are being negotiated. The education target goes up, and the transfer from the healthcare access fund into the general fund comes up. And that's, and whether you want, we want to tie those two together or not, I would just say that absent a tax increase, the only way to pay for a big education budget is to find non-tax revenue. And I didn't think that was particularly controversial, but I can see by your looks that perhaps you disagree with that assessment of it.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, I mean, I don't think of it that way. I mean, the Healthcare Access Fund is, when you look at what actually comes out of it, I mean, I think it's very clear to me that this state would be a very different place without that fund. I mean, it's well, take a look at the other body and what their HHS budget looks like. They take a lot of money out of the Healthcare Access Fund. You know, I mean, it's been, right now, a lot of people's health care is being paid for out of that fund, and a lot of statewide health activities are being paid for out of that fund. And were that fund to go away, those things would be very difficult to pay for. So I don't know. I mean, I guess, we'd have to, it's all one, at the end of the day, it's all taxpayer money, and a dollar that you don't have to spend out of the general fund, like I say, the money is fungible. So, I mean, I guess you can put it that way. I never thought of it that way. And I think that as we move forward here, we're in a very uncertain world with regard to health care. The federal government is constantly going after Minnesota and other states in terms of, you know, now we're being told again that the Affordable Care Act is going to be repealed. So the streams of money coming to the state and what we're going to be able to do is very, very uncertain. And so from my point of view, to say that we're just going to stop collecting these funds at this time when healthcare is more uncertain than ever, and Minnesotans, I think, really rely on what we've been able to do. And very importantly, the fund gives us some opportunity to innovate, as when Republicans used it for the reinsurance pool, that we would not otherwise have. So maybe I'm not exactly addressing your question. Maybe you think it's that it allows us to do something that isn't, you know, above board. I don't look at it that way at all. I think of this as an absolutely essential fund that gives people access to health care. Now, does it sometimes get used in ways that some of us would not think really are appropriate for that fund? Yes. That's been done on both sides. But to just say, well, we don't need it, give it away, I just cannot imagine what the state would be like without the Healthcare Access Fund.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, I know you and I have a different opinion on the provider tax expiring. I view it as part of the global agreement we negotiated in 2011 with Mark Dayton. Governor Dayton, I understand that you have a different perspective on it. That's not the purpose of my questioning. My questioning is that it seems to me that the Healthcare Access Fund, for all practical purposes, has just become an extension of the general fund, and that we should just stop pretending. But the Healthcare Access Fund is anything other than that, because even when it's being used for healthcare, it's being used as a revenue stream to reduce the general fund impact on healthcare spending. And then that money is being used for other purposes in the general fund. And that's my perspective on it, and I just wanted to know what your thoughts are on the Healthcare Access Fund being used for that yet again at the end of the session.
Representative Garofalo, was that?
Yeah, it was a question.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, I mean, I think that there is some, with the Healthcare Access Fund, I think there was some promise that this is for healthcare. And the fact that we can spend it out of that fund and then not have to take it out of the general fund, I mean, let's face it, leadership in both parties, whichever party's in charge, likes to give pretty small targets to HHS compared to other areas. And I can understand why. I mean, it is a fast-growing area. There's a reason why it is, and that's because the needs are growing. We've got a growing population. More of us are older. More of us have disabilities. Healthcare keeps getting more expensive. there are a lot of reasons why that is growing. And so I think of the Healthcare Access Fund as somewhat of a safety valve for that, because we can, you know, we get these really small general fund targets, and we do have some flexibility to be able to make sure that people get health care. I do think that we do need to think, you know, I'm not against rethinking kind of the what the parameters are around use of that fund and how it gets used, but at the end of the day, you can't bind another legislature. So the fact that some people may use it when they shouldn't, I mean, that's kind of a matter for debate when it happens.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Liebling, for the conversation.
Okay, and I think we've got just one more person, Representative Schumacher, and then I think we'll be ready to vote. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe this question will be for Mr. Berg. I'm just wondering, the one piece we really didn't discuss in the committee hearings over the last couple of weeks on this bill are the FTEs and the costs associated with those. Do we have an estimate or a solid number on what this bill does for FTEs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schumacher, I do not know the total. Your staff and I corresponded about this last night, and the budget book does include them for most initiatives. I have not had the time to total them up. I don't know if possibly I can get you that number, but I don't know it off the top of my head.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Liebling renews her motion that House File 2414, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the Tax Committee. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. We have for tomorrow, I'm reminded by Ms. Conley that we have added the jobs bill to the agenda pending referral from the Tax Committee. And we explained that at the beginning. That deals with the target problem that we have for Representative Horne, for the target for the tails. Representative Horne.
Mr. Chair, it says on our internet page for the committee that we'll be recessing at 3:30. Is that still the case?
No, we're
tomorrow.
Oh, tomorrow. You're talking about tomorrow?
Tomorrow, yes.
Yeah, well, that's tomorrow's caucus day, so
yeah.
We have to work around that.
Okay.
Yeah. I thought you were talking about now.
No, sorry.
About to say we're done.
Yeah.
By the way, anybody in the audience that, being that this bill is about 1,000 pages, if any members want to leave their bill, anybody in the audience, it'll save them some printing if they want to pick it up.
We changed the bill, Mr. Chairman.
So. Well, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess recycling. That's true. I just thought of looking at all this paper. Okay, with that, we are adjourned.